already half an hour late,
no,
but there's lunch,
only
so
half an hour.
Only half an hour late. Okay. Well, I don't think that with you guys, Tim needs any introduction. Maybe then he will be talking about. It will be the first. The second quantum shape dynamics inspired discussion in this workshop. We had a nice debate yesterday, led by Astrid. So this will add quite a bit, I hope, to that. So okay.
I'm coming from an entirely different perspective than what Astrid was talking about. So thank you for the introduction, Flavio, and for accommodating me, so I did not have to travel to PI, which is
just an announcement. If you want to talk to him, this is his ear, so you will have to ask me. Okay. Please.
Okay. So I want to talk about what would quantum field theory look like if shape dynamics was fundamental? So doing something similar to a supposed quantum theory of gravity that is based on shape dynamics, and taking its quantum field theory in a curved background limit, and imagine what that limit would look like. So now I need. So my motivation is just this question, what would a QFT look like if shape dynamics is fundamental? So now I see, as soon as I look at the slides in the talk, I see typos. I didn't see them before. So the motivations for this are, of course, that we want to make predictions based on shape dynamics. I mean, there were talks about whether there are classical differences, but of course we hope that the differences will be subtle, but maybe the quantum theories that we see based on shape dynamics are really different. So that is one motivation for that. Then a very important question is, if shape dynamics is fundamental, and if the road is, there is a fundamental quantum theory that is based on the relational ideas, or that somehow is built with the relational ideas that underlie shape dynamics, is then there any way to take a reasonable limit that is compatible with a local quantum field theory in curved space-time or just the Minkowski space? Because these theories are what we use every day and that we apply very successfully to explain our everyday experience. So that's a very important testing ground, whether you can attain this limit. Then another, the question that actually motivated me the most was the question whether space-time as an effective description of what you get out of this dynamical system that we call shape dynamics, whether such an effective space-time description exists also in the deep quantum regime, or whether space-time in all its has to be abandoned completely, whether the concept of space-time and space-time geometry has to be abandoned completely in the quantum regime. And of course, when you quantize, so my strategy for this talk is to look at weak matter fluctuations and what their quantum field theories look like. But of course, you could also ask what would be graviton fluctuations, what would they look like if they were quantized in this framework. So let me start by telling you what assumptions I make. So I assume that there is an unknown, really fundamental quantum theory of gravity. I mean, I won't specify that theory at all because nobody knows what it's supposed to be. But I assume that it is built with the fundamental principles, with the fundamental relational principles that went into the construction of shape dynamics, our understanding of this dynamical system. So that means that the theory should have a limit. I mean, that's what I assume, is that the theory should have a limit in which geometry is, for all practical purposes, described by this dynamical system, and that this limit is attained or can be formally attained as something like a gravitational tree-level approximation to a shape dynamics-based path integral formulation of this fundamental theory. Although I just take this path integral as a formal object to illustrate what a possible starting point could be. I don't assume that the fundamental theory has to look like that at all. So if you do this, then you have to do some steps to come from this quantum gravity theory, from this assumed theory, to a quantum field theory for matter fluctuations. And these steps are in the first two steps are somewhat heuristic. The remaining steps are derivations. So the first two steps is that you start out with some educated guess about the path integral, and you make a saddle point approximation in the gravity sector, and assume that the gravitational loops are suppressed for the matter path integral, and that's reasonable. They should be suppressed by the matter momentum scale over the Planck scale, just on dimensional grounds. Then you make reasonable assumptions about weak matter fluctuations, what they should look like. And then you can really, once you have made these assumptions, you can start turning the crank. You can really do things that are textbook knowledge. So you can, for example, when you have a path integral, if it's reasonably well behaved, you can derive the standard canonical quantum framework from this, and with standard techniques. Then I want to go on and use the background symmetries, the remaining symmetries that the saddle point approximation in the gravity sector has, to derive symmetries for the effective matter path integral. And then I want to represent these symmetry generators in the canonical framework. And so I have a procedure in which I start out with some idea about the quantum gravity path integral, and I use this procedure to derive properties for the effective matter quantum field theories. And some of these steps can be really there. They're really straightforward technical steps that can be discussed model independently, and that's what I want to do first. Then I will give you as an example the derivation of a free scalar field theory in Minkowski space, starting from a particular regime of an ADM-based path integral with approximately at a in an approximately Minkowski background, and then I want to show how the story changes when you base this on shape dynamics. So the first step is you start out with a formal path integral. So I have here a partition function, and I have metric variables, so spatial metric and metric momenta, a canonical path integral. I have matter fields and momenta. For simplicity, I use bosonic fields. The notation would just be a little bit more cumbersome if I had also fermionic matter fields. Then I have Lagrange multipliers for the matter constraints for the constraints, and then I have ghosts and anti-ghosts to implement the Fadeev-Popov determinant. I have a formal delta function of gauge fixing conditions, and I have my source term that is linearly coupled to the field, and then I have the interesting part of the path integral, so exponential to the I over h bar of the canonical action, which has a term that contains the symplectic potential, a term that contains the Lagrange multipliers, an integral over time of the total Hamiltonian, and the Fadeev-Popov determinant.
Excuse me, Tim. You're integrating away all the gravitational degrees of freedom.
So in the first step, I want to make now a saddle point approximation for the gravitational degrees of freedom. And so I integrate.
Okay, so the partition function is really also a function of a background that you choose.
Yes. So now this is exactly the meaning of the last thing I wrote on this formula, is that I set GAB and pi AB to some classical solutions, and that I have some on-shell Hamiltonian that then arises from choosing a particular form of the lapse and shift. And then I get under the path integral, I get a one loop. Under the matter path integral, still I get a one loop determinant, this calligraphy N. But I said that I want to only look at the lowest order in graviton loops. So this will, so the dependence on matter fields of this N will have Planck suppression for all matter degrees of freedom. So for the purpose of doing low energy physics, the lowest order is independent of the matter degrees of freedom. So it's just a normalization constant that I can pull outside of the path, of this path integral. So now I did this step just to motivate that I have a path integral that looks like that, with some classical solutions inserted, with some symmetry properties that come from the ADM system or shape dynamic system, and a Hamiltonian that comes from using a particular classical solution. So now this step is actually the next step would actually be the most straightforward, and it's actually those things are done in quite a number of textbooks. So you can, for example, take a path integral and derive a canonical quantum framework from it, and it needs several steps, but under reasonable conditions they can always be performed. First thing is to derive canonical commutation relations from Schwinger-Dyson equations, where you have approaching time slices, and then the time ordering in the path integral generates this commutator that you're interested in, and you can derive the canonical commutation relations. Then derive a jointness relations by splitting the fields in real modes, and so this is the K index is now a collective index for modes, and they are supposed. I assume that these K modes are real, so as integration variables, and. That way, I impose that the associated operators are self-adjoint operators. With that, I can define creation and relation operators in the standard way. I can derive that normal ordered products, that the vacuum expectation value of normal ordered products vanish. So I get the Fock state for that. And from the Schwinger-Dyson equations, I can, for the momenta, I can, for example, derive the operator equations of motion. So this is all straightforward.
There is a question by Lee.
Yes.
Tim, this is pretty formal. Where does it show up, for example, that to have a well-defined notion of normal ordering, you need a killing, time-like killing vector on the solution of the gravitational dynamics?
What I did here is I have already a notion of time here. And the way I presented the argument here, the way I present the argument is I tailor it to proper time gauge in the ADM formalism and to shape dynamics where I have a notion of time ordering in the path integral. Otherwise, I don't have that. So you're right, to have an independent, a covariant statement, you need a time-like killing vector field. Yes. But here I assume that I have already a notion of a time ordering in the system.
Yes, but does this notion of time ordering depend on the solution, the classical solution of the gravitational equations you're expanding around, or is it prior to that?
Yes. No, it is not prior to that. In this, in what I'm doing, it comes out of that. I'm not doing it before. I can't do it before.
But is that important just for the time ordering, or does it rely on a time-like vector, killing vector field? Because I'm worried about when you generalize to shape dynamics, when if you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, whether
I'm not sure. What I will do here is I will use something that at the end that is asymptotically flat, and what I'm presenting is the argument when you have asymptotic flatness. If you don't have that, I'm not sure whether these steps go through in this way. I mean, what I want to do is I want to do something that looks like an asymptotically flat region at the end.
Okay, thank you.
So, and then I want to have, and then the step where it really deviates is I want to have a representation of my symmetry generators. So the background symmetries, the symmetries that leave the gravitational solution invariant, they will in these particular cases they will translate into symmetries of the action. And then you can derive word identities that give you the symmetries of the effective path integral. So I have symmetry actions of symmetries on my Fock space that I want to construct. And so these symmetries by the Wigner theorem have to be represented as unitary or anti-unitary transformations. So that tells me that my Hilbert space has to has to be decomposable into unitary irreducible representations of the symmetry group, then by knowing the actions of the symmetry transformations on some of the matter fields or on the or some of the symmetry transformations, I can deduce that they have to what the actions on particular modes is. And what is particularly important is that if some symmetries are realized as linear transformations that act on the fields by basically deleting a mode and replacing it with a transformed mode, then these transformations have unambiguous quantizations. The generator is just this quadratic generator that I wrote here. So delete a mode and replace it with the transformed mode. And then I can use the representation theory of the symmetry group on this set of modes to determine also, so now I have some generators that have to, that I know have an unambiguous quadratic quantization, but for example, the Hamiltonian, if you're in an interacting theory, would not have a quadratic representation. But I know from the algebra of the symmetry generators that I know already the quadratic part, and I get algebraic conditions on the higher order, on the interaction parts. And I can also derive that just from the word identity, that the vacuum is up to a phase left invariant under symmetry transformations. Then you would you would redefine the action of your symmetry group to get an invariant transformation. So now I want to apply this now to derive a Minkowski quantum field theory in Minkowski space from the ADM description. So what I have here is I assume that the gravitational data is just the spatially flat metric. So I use the standard flat slicing of Minkowski. And I use evolution in proper time gauge. So I choose a lapse that is unity everywhere. And that means that the gauge fixed Hamiltonian in the path integral that I wrote here, this matter Hamiltonian is just the matter Hamilton density integrated over all space. So now I have I look at the symmetries of this background. So the effective matter action has to be invariant under those gauge transformations that leave classical background data invariant. And of course, we all know which transformations leave them invariant. They're the translations, their rotations, their time translations, and their Lorentz boost. And we also, it's just, you plug these lapses and shifts into the constraint algebra, and at least formally, you obtain the Poincaré algebra from this. So these generators satisfy the Poincaré algebra, and they have a particular localization property in space-time. So now some of these generators, those that are purely spatial diffeomorphisms, so the translations and rotations here, where the lapse vanishes, they have a linear representation on matter fields, and that's just because their generator is the momentum of the matter field lead derivative times the lead derivative of the matter field in the direction of this vector field, and that is just that diffeomorphisms drag matter fields around in space. And that means those the diffeomorphisms have an unambiguous quadratic quantization as translations and rotation generators. And now I can use the algebraic relations I can use how the Poincaré algebra closes to determine the quadratic part of the Hamiltonian and the boost generator. But of course, the Hamiltonian boost generators may also have interaction terms. So now, one thing that forbids most interactions, and that is actually the big stumbling block, is you want the generators to satisfy the Poincaré algebra. You want the generators to be essentially self-adjoint. You want the generators not to polarize the vacuum, so they should be normal ordered. And you want that the generators are local, because the matter Hamiltonian that you get out of this with proper time gauge with n equals 1 and just setting the spatial metric to be the flat metric, that is just local in the field. So you want local interactions if you start out with a local path integral. So there's no way around that. But if you do that, then you have now all the ingredients for quantum field theory on Minkowski space. So most of us learned this as graduate students, the unitary irreducible representations of the Poincaré. They are labeled by the Casimir operators, by the invariant, by the rest mass squared, so by the momentum squared, and the Pauli-Lubanski vector, the squared, which give you essentially the mass and the spin. I mean, the eigenvalues are mass squared times spin plus one, but essentially this is mass and spin. So the irreducible representations are labeled by masses and spins. And the representation, the states in the representation spaces are then labeled by momenta and spin and internal spin degrees of freedom. So now I can construct a Minkowski quantum field theory just from that. I do the simplest possible example. It's a free scalar field theory. I take a positive mass and I take the spin to be zero. That means that this spin label lambda has to be zero, and I can just suppress it for the rest. And that means that my modes are just labeled as momentum modes. And then I have creation operators for these momentum modes. Then I can use what I know about translations and rotations. And now with my assumption that I have a free field theory, that there is no higher order part, that it's just the quadratic part, I can also get the generator of time translations and of boosts. And I just wrote down the standard representation of that. So that is how I motivate to derive a quantum field theory in Minkowski space from the from starting with the ADM description and its symmetries. So now I want to do the same thing, but I start out with a path integral that is based on shape dynamics, on the ideas of shape dynamics.
Tim,
yes?
Can I ask you a question? Sorry. So you gave the example of free scalar field, but if there are interactions, so are you going to derive the form of the Hamiltonian with the creation and annihilation operators out of the form of the Hamiltonian constraint in proper time gauge or what? So
no, so you mean do I derive what the interaction is? Or
I mean
okay, so far no. The problem is now is I calculated things here. So far what I did was I used all this story that I told you at the beginning to get a set of rules to get a set of postulates out of my quantum gravity theory that I want to impose on my quantum theory, on the quantum field theory. And so now what I impose is actually a set of rules that says I have a Poincaré invariant vacuum, I have a mode, I have creation operators for these modes, so I can construct a Fock space out of this vacuum, and I have a particular form of the symmetry generators, and now the interactions, they have to satisfy a number of postulates. One, they have to be non-polarizing. So this means that they have to be normal ordered. That's not that's a non-trivial point, because usually normal ordering requires you to remove infinities, and these infinities may be, you know, they may be, when you have something that is non-quadratic, they may be multiplied with operators, so you have to renormalize that part. And but what is even more complicated is to implement locality and a self-adjointness of these operators. And at the end, I don't know of any example of where you can rigorously define a self-adjoint, non-polarizing, local interaction term. This is not Haag's theorem. Haag's theorem points out a particular infrared problem. Which is related to this, but it's not the problem that occurs in Haag's theorem. So right now I'm not deriving any. If you want to systematically look for interaction terms, you could just I give you a set of rules and you check what interactions this set of rules would allow. So in this sense, I am deriving it, but I'm not but not constructively, just in terms of the set of rules that I give you here.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so let's go on and let's do this to the let's assume this for shape dynamics. So again, I set gravitational data. I want the spatial metric to be flat. I want the metric momenta to vanish, and since the trace part of the metric momenta vanish by a constraint in shape dynamics, I specify that the trace free part is vanishing here. Then I set an effective I calculate an effective Hamiltonian here. And this is actually, if I wanted to do this rigorously, I would have to spend an entire talk on that. This is, but it's really the point where the relational picture that Julian has taught us comes in. And this is essentially, this Hamiltonian comes from, is the York Hamiltonian, so it's the on-shell value of the volume. And I take, and I consider a universe that is empty almost everywhere, that is closed without, has spatially compact topology and no boundary. And this, and I look at gravitational data that looks, for all practical purposes, for this small matter system that is sitting somewhere there, as if this matter system was sitting in asymptotically flat space-time. Then, once I have that, then I can calculate how the York Hamiltonian, how the on-shell value of the Hamiltonian has to depend on the matter degrees of freedom. So now I get, so this is what the first term is in this Hamiltonian, the on-shell value depending on the matter degrees of freedom. But when I want to take the really asymptotically flat limit, I have to make this region infinitely large. So this becomes an infinite volume, and I have to subtract the background volume, so the bare volume of this, if there was no matter. And then the difference is still divergent, and I have to ask, what do I have to do? What time reparametrization do I have to do from York time, which is cosmological expansion, to a time variable that is appropriate to describe the evolution in at short timescales, at timescales that are much, much shorter than the expansion of the universe, but are typical timescales for the evolution of the matter subsystem that I'm considering here. And if I do all this carefully, then I can derive a matter Hamiltonian for something that is, for all practical purposes, asymptotically flat. And this matter Hamiltonian, I cannot solve it completely analytically, but I can solve it when I can derive it when I look at weak matter fluctuations. And for weak matter fluctuations, I introduce a perturbation parameter epsilon that multiplies the matter fields. And I look what the lowest order in epsilon is, and I find that at lowest order I get the quadratic part of the Hamilton density that you write in the scalar constraints for the matter part of the scalar constraints of GR, multiplied by the CMC lapse, and that integrated over all space. And then I get higher order terms, and those higher order terms contain self-interactions, so non-quadratic parts of the matter Hamiltonian. They contain self-gravity and genuine matter-gravity matter interactions. So I mean, you can organize these. You can give each term its own name, for example, at second order or at third order. But that's what you get. What you observe here is that the matter Hamiltonian is at lowest order local, because this is just the background gravity CMC lapse, which is then for this asymptotically flat data one, if you set the correct boundary conditions that I motivate also from a different setting, also from this relation, from the relational ideas, but then you see that the higher order terms are non-local, because and the non-localities come from the gravitational interactions between matter fields. They insert inverse differential operators between matter terms, between lower order matter terms, and that's where the non-locality comes from.
Tim, sorry, another question. Here you're putting in the same bowl or the in the order epsilon all interactions, gravitational and known. We know that there is a hierarchy, right?
So you can also do that is right. You can now do a Planck expansion. So expand the each order of epsilon again in terms of Newton's constant.
But actually, I would do the opposite. I would start with a Planck expansion because we did it already for the prefactor in the path integral. And so, right?
Okay. Yeah. Yes. You can. You can do that. The problem is if you're not careful, you don't solve the Lichtenherz-Yerkes equation self-consistently. So in this case, I solve it. You may be able to just. I'm not saying that this is that it's not working. It's just I haven't done it that way.
I guess you have to solve to get the laps that you get from the. With interactions, no?
Yes. You would. I can imagine that it just looks like that, but I haven't done the calculation where I did this separation. Okay. So I can't tell you what the terms look like there.
Tim, another question. So this lab CMC that you have there, it doesn't contain inverse Laplacians because you're looking at a...
No, it does. It does contain inverse Laplacians, but it just depends on background data. It doesn't... These inverse Laplacians act on background data, not on the matter data that I want to quantize.
Okay, thanks.
That's where my claim comes from. Okay, so I go to the next slide. Now I look at the background symmetries that I have, so the conformal isometries which are the invariances of the Yerkes Hamiltonian, and they are generated by a linear combination of spatial diffeomorphisms and conformal transformations, and we know what leaves this data here invariant. They're just the conformal isometries of Euclidean 3 space, so they're translations and rotations as, because they're isometries of Euclidean 3 space. And then you have also dilatations, so the homogeneous dilatations and special conformal transformations. And we also know that this is these are the generators of the conformal group in three dimensions, which is, as a Lie algebra, the de Sitter Lie algebra. And moreover, when you derive the Hamiltonian in the way that I derived it here, you see that it becomes proportional to the dilatational charge, to the generator of dilatations at lowest order. At the order of expansion that I did here. And so now I have the postulates that I want for my shape dynamics based theory. I want that it has a C3 invariant vacuum, that the modes carry a representation of the translations and rotations, that the algebra closes for dilatations and special conformal transformations, and that time evolution is generated by a generator that is proportional to the dilatational charge. Again, here I use that I know how spatial diffeomorphisms act on matter degrees of freedom. So, of course, I could say I'm completely agnostic about what one of these generators, CA, is doing. But since the job of diffeomorphisms is to move matter fields around, and since they are represented by linear transformations on the matter fields, I have an unambiguous quantization for translations and rotations. I just don't know what the conformal generator does to the matter part. I know what it would do to the gravitational part, but I don't know what it does to the matter part. So I just leave it undetermined and use the algebraic relations of the unitary representations of the conformal group to determine what it has to be. So now the representation theory for the de Sitter group or the conformal group in three dimensions is closely related to the... So people who are familiar with SO4, for example, from older spinform models, or people who are who know about the Lorentz group, they for them this is very familiar. You have two Casimirs, a quadratic Casimir and a quartic Casimir, and I wrote the expression of the quadratic Casimir in terms of the generator. So it's the dilatational generator squared minus angular momentum squared minus 2 times the anticommutator of special conformal transformations and momenta and translations. And then there are two numbers, P and Q. This is the standard parametrization for these for the Casimir eigenvalues. And you see that if you want to have a unitary representation, so all generators are essentially self-adjoint, then P has to be a non-negative integer and Q has to be 1/2 plus I times a non-negative real number. In addition to, this is the main series of that, like the main series for the Lorentz group representations, there are additional complementary and discrete series. And the representation space is really what you know from SO4 representations. It looks like a tensor product of two SU2 representations. So now I have this. It would take about 3 slides to write down the matrix elements for the generators. It's straightforward. It's just not instructive for the purpose of this talk. So what I want is I postulate a Hilbert space with a C3 invariant vacuum state. I have Fock creation operators now on this state for my matter modes. They're now labeled by these 4 integers. And actually, there is a positive energy condition which comes from like what you do when you have a positive energy modes for the Poincaré, for the representations of the Lorentz and Poincaré group. And they come here from when you solve the expression for the Casimir operator here, which is d squared. When you solve that in a given representation for the value of the for expressing the dilatational charge in terms of the other generators, and which root you pick, if you pick the positive root, so a positive energy brand, or the negative minus the root which is the positive energy minus the root is actually positive energy branch, then you get a Hamiltonian that again looks similar to the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian. It looks like it has a p squared term, angular momentum plus this anti-commutator of special conformal transformations and translation, plus a mass term, so that, which is encoded in this nu squared plus 9 fourths. So I have a quadratic Hamiltonian, and now everything here looks like it was a quantum field theory on the sitter space, the sitter invariant theory, except that I localize the modes differently and that I have a different positive energy condition.
Tim, does D have a gap? There's that 9/4 there. Even if
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it has a gap. It certainly looks because of the 9/4 like it has, but I don't know what the spectrum of the anti commutator of special conformal transformations and translations is.
Isn't that a positive operator?
I think it is a positive operator, I certainly know that it's bounded from below because this operator here is, as you see on the right hand side, with the values of p and q that I insert here, that is that satisfies that has a lower bound that follows from this from the right hand side here. I'm not sure whether the lower bound is really zero. I have to look at the representation theory again.
Yeah, okay.
To tell you that. So the important difference is that these modes are localized in three space and not on the sitter space, and that is where this quantum field theory looks becomes different. So now I have here I've written the modes in terms of J1 M1 J2 M2. Of course you can then go you can then solve the eigenvalue equation for this Laplacian and get the explicit mode equation, and that is actually done in the literature, and you can look it up and insert that and insert these solutions. So that tells you how these modes are localized, how they're related to fields that have support in a certain region in space. So before I conclude, let me give you one little sidetrack, and that is the role of Lorentz symmetry in this whole framework. At first, when I looked at this at the representation theory of C3, I thought, well, that's really nice. There is a well-known Wigner contraction of C3 to ISO 3-1 to the Poincaré group, and so I have. Naturally, through this process of Wigner contraction, I have naturally the Poincaré group emerging from this. However, that turns out to be a red herring. And the reason for that is when you do this rescaling, if you do the rescaling that you have to do to get to get the Wigner contraction that gives you the ISO 3-1, then the physical interpretation of the modes that I had from before when I derived this form of the Hamiltonian is not compatible with the physical interpretation of the Wigner contraction that I have to do to contract these generators to the Poincaré generators. So essentially, you know what you do. You take the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of translations and special conformal transformations, make this symmetric combination, becomes then the spatial components of the then become the spatial components of the four momentum, and the anti-symmetric turn into the boost generators. But the rescaling of generators and the limit over representations that you have, which is taking a limit over these nus here, is not compatible with this. So this is why it's mathematically formally correct, but physically, to me, it makes no sense. I mean, unless someone can tell me a better physical story about it.
Timmy, what happens to to the spectrum of D in the limit when you do the Nono-Wigner contraction?
So if you do that, then you get the usual continuous spectrum you get the usual continuous spectrum. So you get that the Hamiltonian becomes square root of p squared plus m squared, where now, let me look it up, m is the is this nu squared over the contraction parameter squared. Mm-hmm. And you have to contract the J's in a particular way, and you have to contract but it's simply not the contraction that I would want, that I would physically motivate from taking the asymptotically flat limit. That's why
probably the spectrum is okay, even in the form of D, but then what you're saying is that the modes are not the eigenvalues of the moment, three momenta that you would like to.
Yes. The I have beforehand, because I know how the diffeomorphisms drag the modes around, I have a physical interpretation of how modes are localized already from that. And then that's just not compatible with this point. So this is why I'm putting this caveat in. But I just wanted to make a really very simple observation about the role of Lorentz symmetry. And this is, yesterday I was listening to Philip's talk, and he was talking about relational observables. So this is, you have in this case here, I look at relational observables in the matter sector. So what I imagine is you have a multiplet of fields, and then the relational observables are the coincidences of particular field values. So for example, if the first four field components take a certain value, then what values do the other field components take? And this is, in general, a horrible multivalued function, or the answer is an empty set. But that gives you complete relational observables that do not require any diffeomorphism gauge fixing or any notion of background geometry. Now, if you say I can only observe these relational observables, then you see that that this matter Hamiltonian that I, where did I write it here, that this matter Hamiltonian, when it comes from a standard matter Hamiltonian, that there are different sets of initial data, Lorentz transformed initial data for matter, that give you the same relational observables. And that is mathematically, the reason for that is because this matter Hamiltonian has Lorentz symmetry. It's this thing, this object here. And you put in n equals 1, and you put in the spatially flat metric, and you have a p squared plus grad phi squared plus m squared phi squared. That is invariant under, that is form invariant under Lorentz transformations. And that's the reason why you get the same relational observables out of this. So that's the mathematical or the technical where Lorentz invariance comes in. But physically, it's due to our inability to deduce a unique, to invert a given set of these relational observables, a given complete set of, for a unique set of initial data. We can only determine them up to these Lorentz transformations. So it's this indeterminacy where Lorentz symmetry comes in this framework. And that's all I can say. I would like to give it a more fundamental role, but at the moment I have ideas, but nothing that I that really works to do that. So let me come to the conclusions. So I gave you a quasi-heuristic derivation of quantum field theory in Minkowski space from a quantum gravity path integral, from a canonical quantum gravity path integral. Then I used the same method of derivation and applied it to a shape dynamics path integral. And I derived a different set of rules that has to be, or I deduced a different set of rules that has to be satisfied by a quantum field theory that that comes out of such a procedure. And this quantum field theory has the C3 invariants, so invariants under the conformal group in three dimensions. But it has very different locality properties and localization properties. The eigenmodes mode expansion is different from the one that you know in Minkowski space, and also the representation of dilatations is not simply making things larger or smaller. They have a non-trivial action on the set of modes. And then I also found that the Hamiltonian is proportional to the dilatation charge. And that's actually not surprising because if you do a multipole expansion of this expression here, you see that both the Hamiltonian and the dilatation charge have as leading contribution the 0-0 spherical harmonic times and that's and also because of the symmetry properties that they have. So this is actually not so surprising that it appears. And I don't know what to make of Lorentz invariance in this. I know it's there in this theory, but it doesn't have a fundamental. A fundamental status like for quantum field theory in Minkowski space, but there is an action of in a sense, at least coming from the classical theory, there is a sense in which there is Lorentz invariance in the theory. So this is really just the starting point of, I'm just scratching the surface here of what shape dynamics can teach us about quantum field theories. And there are many future directions, many questions that I'm interested in. So one is One is the thing that I already mentioned as the motivation. Which was my motivation to look at this for, at the very beginning, to test the limitations of the description of the state of gravity in terms of space-time. When we get the information about what the state of gravity is, we get it through the filter, through the carrier of quantum fields. They tell us what is happening, or what the state of space-time is, of gravity is, and whether this state can be can be effectively described by a space-time geometry, or whether this has to be abandoned. It was really the motivating question, but this ultimately brought me to think about the measurement problem in quantum mechanics for various reasons. To make solid statements here. Then a second point is, I told you I have different locality properties of my Hamiltonian. I have a different algebra of symmetry generators. In fact, although you can Wigner contract, although you can Wigner contract all C3 Europes, the image of these Wigner contractions do not give you all unitary representations of the Poincaré group. So there are some restrictions. For example, you cannot have tachyons. You cannot obtain tachyons in this through this Wigner contraction.
Good.
But there are interesting technical differences, and it's a question whether one can build a standard model from these C3 invariant QFTs. That's a completely open. It looks very similar, but the detail is not equivalent. Construct a non-local interacting Hamiltonian. So maybe one can evade problems because of local QFT in space-time. I don't know. I mean that is a long shot, of course. Then I gave you this my current understanding of the role of Lorentz invariants in this asymptotically flat shape dynamics. So the question is, if Lorentz invariance is something very subtle that appears on shell for a particular set of observables, it's also something that is very fragile. And may it be broken at higher orders? May it be, And that would really tell us something important about shape dynamics, because Lorentz invariance is one of the most well tested. Tests of Lorentz invariance have very high precisions. So if it's something that is too fragile, if it's broken too easily in this way of doing quantum field theory, then we have to think about what ingredients we have to put in at the very beginning, at the very construction of the relational model these ideas that Julian has been developing about that motivated us to think about the York a dynamical system in terms of shape dynamics, maybe we have to put in some more ingredients there. And then of course the last point is to quantize gravitational fluctuations. So quantize gravitational waves actually. So transverse traceless spin two modes, and learn what the difficulties are when you want an interaction Hamiltonian for them. To learn about what the technical problems are that we are facing when we try to do quantum shape dynamics. And I mean, this is obviously just the first try when you do that, but it's something that can be done with rather straightforward machinery. So thank you. That's how far I wanted to get in this talk.
Thank you, Tim. Are there questions?
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
I have a question which you may have already said something about, but I missed. So in your when you write down the J1, M1, J2, M2 in characterizing your states, are they coming from the same combinations of special conformal transformations and rotations or not?
Okay, so let me read it. I wrote it for myself to make it to make it clear. So the C3 is SO41. SO41 contains as a subalgebra, of course, SO4. And the SO4 contains these SU2 left and SU2 right generators. So these SU2 left and SU2 right generators, they are related to the usual chase on the left and right component of the SO4 representation, and they are a linear combination of the translation and special conformal generators. So they're symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations, plus the angular momentum. And then you build the ladder operators by adding dilatational and the third component, so the preferred component of the that you use to construct the set direction that you use to construct your SU2 left right, and so it's not these J's and M's, they're not the eigenvalues of special conformal or generators themselves or of translation. They're a linear combination of them.
Any other questions?
Hi, Tim. Thanks.
Hi.
So, two things. One. This what you mentioned about Lorentz, the emergence of Lorentz mm-hmm. symmetry, is very similar, right, to what we were talking about in the collapse scenarios, where it's not fully determined and you have this undetermined thing that would actually choose between different possible slicings, and the different possible slicings, for instance, in Minkowski represent they're related by boost, they're related by Lorentz transformations. Right.
Yes, actually, my understanding for these things comes from looking at Rindler wedges, and I mean, this is how we had. So, for the rest of the people who are attending this talk, and Hickey and I had about a month ago had very intensive discussions about this ambiguity, and this ambiguity is closely related to the ambiguity of that you can find many Rindler wedges in Minkowski space.
Okay, and the second thing that I wanted to ask you about is that in CFTs they usually have this radio quantization where they basically replace the evolution in time by a scale transformation, mm-hmm. and
In a sense, that's what's happening here. It's just I don't put this in by hand. I just say I want that the diffeomorphisms really drag modes around in space, and then I have some algebraic relations that have to be satisfied by the generators, and then I just get from the shape dynamics passing, but the time evolution has to be generated by this dilatational generator. But the spirit is very different from radial quantization. The spirit in radial quantization is really goes through space-time.
That's right.
And whereas here I'm not assuming that at all. I have a dynamical system. I have certain generators and they have certain actions on my modes, and on top of that I have knowledge about what a generator of dynamics should be.
Okay.
So I don't know whether that's a coincidence or whether there is something deeper.
Mm-hmm. We should.
It certainly looks similar.
Okay. Maybe
a last question, if no one else. What about Hugg's theorem? Is there a workaround here that because of the different location?
I don't know. I don't know about Hugg's theorem. At first, I thought what the locality properties, what they would do is give a workaround Hugg's theorem, but when you look at technically what the problem is with Hugg's theorem, it's an infrared problem. It's that you have asymptotic states. It's not a UV problem. Whereas what I get here is the what you get here when you look at this and you want to add interaction terms to the Hamiltonian, you want them to be local. You want them to be you want the Hamiltonian to be non-polarizing, essentially self-adjoint, and satisfy the Poincaré algebra. It's just too much to ask for here. So I don't, but that is independent of Hugg's theorem. You know,
I thought that was the point, right? You can't construct interactions that way.
Well, when you look at the technicalities of the proof, it's actually that one way of formulating is that the interaction picture is ill-defined, that there is no unitary transformation from the interacting field theory to the asymptotic states that are completely separated. To the asymptotic particle states.
All right. If there's no
and that turns out to be due to a problem in the infrared, not the UV of the theory. So I'm not 100% certain, but I think those are two independent issues.
Okay.
They may be related, but to my knowledge, they're independent.
We gotta talk about that more in private. Yeah, okay. So let's thank Tim again.